Hello, Buzzkillers. It's the professor here. Scholarly history books are built on years of hard work and dozens of archives, usually in multiple countries. They're the result of immense amounts of time spent reading and analyzing historical sources, presenting preliminary findings at academic conferences, testing interpretations in journal articles, showing the work to other experts in the field, taking their criticisms into account, and uncounted and uncountable hours thinking about the history you've discovered and how best to present it in a book. Your favorite member of the Buzzkill Institute, Professor Philip Nash from Penn State, has just published his new book, Breaking Protocol, America's First Female Ambassadors, 1933 to 1964. We're talking about it in this episode, and of course, it's on the Buzzkill bookshelf. Professor Nash was kind enough to come on the show in its early days and help move it from its original jokey format to the more grown-up and, I hope, thoughtful show that you've come to know now. He was willing to keep coming on the show during the difficult years when we were trying to find our feet, when we were dead flat broke, and he has devoted days and days of his own personal time to interviews. More than any other person we've had on the show, I owe the show's success to him. And as we've said many times, his episodes are the most popular, reach the most buzzkillers, and get the most positive feedback of all our shows. Imagine my surprise, therefore, when he thanked me and the podcast on the first page of the acknowledgments section of his Breaking Protocol book. Let me read you what he wrote. Quote, radio host Ron Arrett of 790 WPIC and podcaster Joe Kuhill, a.k.a. Professor Buzzkill, have been incredibly kind and supportive in sharing their respective platforms with me and helping keep alive my love of history. End quote. Well, I can't speak for Ron Arrett, but as far as I'm concerned, Professor Nash has got this exactly backwards. He's the one who's been incredibly kind and supportive of me and the show, and especially patient during its early years. For him to give me a shout-out in the acknowledgments of an important book that he spent 20 years researching and writing is very, very humbling, and I'm very, very grateful. But, you know, talk for me is cheap. Academics who are willing to go out and present history in popular media are few and far between, and no one is better at it than Professor Nash. Unfortunately, in my opinion, this important work, that is, telling the public about serious research, doesn't usually garner historians much credit in their home colleges or universities. There's usually a category for public service or public outreach in the official assessments of faculty members done by university administrators, but I don't think it's given the weight it deserves. So if you're a fan of Professor Nash, please do me a favor. Go to the blog post for this episode on ProfessorBuzzkill.com. There you'll find a couple of email addresses of the relevant high-level administrators at Penn State who I think, and I hope, would really like to hear how much Professor Nash has helped you understand history. So many of you tell me how great he is. Let's get the word to his bosses. Please email them. I can't think of anyone who deserves it more.
Greetings, Buzzkillers. This is Dave Nash, Breaking Protocol from Oakland, California. Totally stoked to hear my brother Phil busting myths and taking names today on Professor Buzzkill.
Yes, that's right, Buzzkillers. Here we are with your favorite Buzzkiller. And of course, I'm not referring to me. I'm referring to Professor Phil Nash from Penn State, who's our most consistent guest and our most popular guest. I get emails and messages all the time about how fantastic he is. Well, there's even more fantasticness today because he's here talking about his brand new, just released book called Breaking Protocol. Professor, how are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. And happy to be talking about my book.
And, well, it's a fantastic book. By the way, we should give the Buzzkillers its full title.
Full title is Breaking Protocol, America's First Female Ambassadors, 1933 to 1964.
And of course, it's going to be on the Buzzkill bookshelf and everywhere else. We'll talk more about that later in the show. So, Professor, why this topic?
It's a great question and one I'm often asked, especially if you look early in my career, like when I was doing graduate school in the late 80s, early 90s, my training was all in sort of national security, the Cold War, nuclear weapons. My dissertation and my first book was about the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And after I was done with that, I don't know why. I did what you're not supposed to do, which is completely change topics. You're supposed to build.
Yeah,
you're supposed to build. You're not just supposed to give up on the building and start a new one. So, but I did that anyway. Anyway, I wanted to do something different. And in the 90s, in my subfield, which is U.S. foreign relations, you had a lot of talk about studying women, studying gender, incorporating gender analysis into the study of U.S. foreign relations. It really was an exciting period in several ways, not just that one. In several ways, the field was sort of opening up and becoming broader and, you know, doing a lot of new things and broadening the definition of what constituted U.S. foreign relations. In fact, we stopped using the term diplomatic history.
We started That's using right. the yeah, term. Yeah.
Yeah, in other words, and there was this stereotype, and there was something to it that, you know, we sort of wrote about what one clerk wrote to another, and it was all about policy and leadership, and, you know, a lot of people wanted to do different things. And so I was intrigued by this notion of women and gender, and what I found is that it struck me is that there were a lot more people talking about doing it than actually doing it.
That was
one of my major motivations.
Problem. Yeah, right.
Yeah, and so I thought that that would be something interesting, and I sort of slid into it via one of the women I talk about, who I'll talk about later, Frances Willis. Nothing had really been written about her. She was the first woman to work her way up through the career Foreign Service. Mm-hmm. And then I decided, you know what, why don't I just do a book on the first female ambassadors, because not much had been written about them, and not deeply and based on some really serious research, at least not at that point.
Huh.
And so I decided to do that. I was also, and then as I got into it, I was interested in the question of sort of who represents us. You know, foreign relations on the ground on a daily basis, that's conducted by diplomats, by ambassadors who run embassies overseas. You don't hear much about them.
Just
generally not a very glamorous job, but it's really crucial. And there are all sorts of points in history where ambassadors actually make a really, really important difference. And then the question is, in a democracy that's increasingly diverse, you wonder sort of how representative is our diplomatic corps. And if you look early in the period I talk about, and I'll talk about this in a minute, it was one of the least diverse areas of the entire federal government. And so then the question in many fields becomes, so how does that change, right? How does our diplomatic corps become more representative? These days it is much more representative than it used to be. It's not representative enough, but we've made a lot of progress. And so for that reason, I thought that this deserved a deeper look. If I can just briefly say something about the sort of the historiography, in other words, the history of the history and how history is written.
Different interpretations, yeah.
Right, and different schools and different approaches. In a way, I have another problem, which is, in a way, what I'm doing is sort of old school women's history.
Yeah.
In other words, you basically tell the untold story about women who have been neglected. That's the sort of traditional women's history that was done in the 70s and 80s, and a lot of people have moved on from.
Right.
And then there are some of the more traditional foreign relations people who will say, well, these are women ambassadors. They represented us in small countries. They're not that important. So the problem with, you could argue big picture that my book falls between two stools, that it's not sort of sophisticated gender history the way gender and women's historians would want now. And it's also not going to be pleasing to the more traditional foreign relations people. So I am bracing myself for some not so positive reviews in the profession. because, like I said, I risk making nobody happy.
Yeah, well, it could also be seen as a bridge, right?
I prefer your interpretation.
Yes. Well, yeah. Right. Okay.
Let's hope.
That's why I'm in show business now, not in truly.
All right. Well, I also. And let me just add one other thing, which is I have also made a real effort in this book to make it as accessible as possible. It has virtually no jargon in it, and when there is jargon, I explain it. It's largely narrative. I have a lot of what I think are colorful anecdotes in it. So I really do think that you don't need to be a hardcore foreign relations specialist to appreciate this. At least that was my intention.
Yeah, and that's hard to do in diplomatic history because there's a lot of jargon that just in the day-to-day working of foreign relations.
Yes, there is.
So I presume there was a time, because of the way gender relations have worked over American history, there was a time when there were no women diplomats.
Sure, no formal diplomats, although I should add there's been a lot of good work done recently on much older periods, like even the Middle Ages and sort of Renaissance and Reformation period. You had a lot of women who, you know, this is before diplomacy was formalized. You did have women playing many informal roles, like, for example, in royal courts. They served as sort of informal, and they were spies, they were go-betweens, they were ambassadors. So they played a lot of roles. And that's been getting some attention recently. By the time you get to the 19th century, diplomacy, like a lot of fields, is professionalized.
Then
it becomes almost solely the province of men.
Oh, that's and interesting. That's interesting. Women get frozen out, right?
Pretty much. All the fields, medicine, law, they all go through professionalization, right? And you have to have a high level of education, et cetera.
Yeah.
And then diplomacy by the late 19th, early 20th century is a man's world if there ever was one. And it's even worse, I would argue, than some other professions. For example, around 1910, 1920 in the United States, there were some women doctors. There were some women lawyers. It wasn't impossible. They were rare, but there were some. But there were no female diplomats. Not a single one. Until 1922.
So why are they excluded in this period? Because, as you say, there are some that break through in the other professions. Is it just because it's in a way it's old school, but it's not old school because I suppose diplomats didn't go back and say, well, in the Middle Ages we had women, so let's use them again, you know.
Right. No, it's a great question. Keep in mind that there's this diplomacy does not exist in a vacuum like any profession.
There is
the overall sort of reigning misogyny and discrimination against women and sexism of that period. But diplomacy in the early 20th century in the United States is very elite. In other words, not just about sex, it's also about race and class. There was this old saw that diplomats were all pale, male, and Yale, which is really not much of an exaggeration. It really isn't.
Yeah.
One of the so-called old hands, as I call them, the sort of founding fathers of the modern Foreign Service in the early 20th century, one of them actually referred to the Foreign Service as a pretty good club, which it's actually the title of a book, and it's a great sort of capsule description of this because it was very, very exclusive. But, you know, and to answer your question, in addition to the just overall societal discrimination and contempt for women, in diplomacy in particular, women were considered not tough enough for the job. Occasionally, there are risks involved in foreign service. Even if you're a low-level vice consul in a seaport, that can be dangerous. Mm-hmm. At the higher levels, you might be involved in negotiation. That also requires toughness, according to these founding fathers, these old hands.
Mm-hmm.
Women
mm-hmm.
were thought to be too emotional.
Mm-hmm.
And there was almost this sort of cult of rationality in the Foreign Service, right? It's supposed to be cold-blooded calculation of the national interest, and that women are too emotional, and so they couldn't be trusted in that sense. The more practical reason is that women were excluded from men's clubs.
Oh, and we should tell buzzkillers, by the way, by men's clubs, we mean social clubs.
Correct.
The Harvard and Yale club or whatever. Various men's clubs, yeah.
Right.
And, where politicians hung out.
Right, absolutely. And where they might have their own building, and it's very exclusive membership.
Right.
And, and those are, you're absolutely right. It's important to sort of explain this, because now, these days, they don't have nearly the presence or the influence they did in the early 20th century. All diplomats and all sort of the elite levels of society, of government, the professions, law, medicine, the social bonds you form at these clubs are absolutely crucial to your business. In other words, they're not separate worlds.
Right, right.
Especially in diplomacy. Diplomacy, you establish trust with your host government or with diplomats in the foreign ministry or diplomats from other countries. You form those bonds in men's clubs where women are excluded. And so we have all sorts of documents where you have men essentially saying, well, you know, we'd love to have a female diplomat, but she can't form the requisite social ties, so we can't have women.
Yeah. And maybe other countries that was even stricter.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and that also leads me to my next point, which is there was worry, and this was legitimate worry, is that if you name a woman diplomat, certainly an ambassador, to another particular country, they might be offended by it. And you see this over and over and over again. I mean, that was not a lie.
Oh, the other government might be offended. Oh,
correct.
Okay.
They might take this as a slap, and that did happen in several cases. Maybe not at the low level, but certainly at the higher level, as we'll see when we get to Claire Booth Luce in Italy, for example. The problem with that argument, even though it's legit, is that you essentially have American men arguing, well, you know, we'd love to admit women, but, you know, these damn backward foreigners. In other words, it allows you to blame the sort of knuckle-dragging foreigner, even though you essentially share their same attitude.
Yeah, right.
there's a little bit of hypocrisy there. And then finally, there was at least one professional diplomat who wrote a book about diplomacy in 1909, I believe, who said that, well, of course women can't be diplomats. They can't keep a secret.
Oh, so there's this kind of like, they're just like our wives. They get a sewing circle going.
Exactly, and then right, exactly. They're gossips. They can't be trusted in that regard, et cetera, et cetera. And I've that was a claim. And I always have seen in their letters and diaries other diplomats making wisecracks along these lines. Like, oh, the new woman minister is arriving and she hasn't said much about her arrival, so at least she can keep a secret.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, these are the layers and the reasons, quote unquote, reasons that men gave to keep women out. I also argue in my first chapter where I sort of set the stage to talk about the male dominated world of American diplomacy. I argue that it doesn't help that on numerous occasions, American diplomats are particularly sensitive to the charge or the stereotype that they're this group of sort of precious, effete, vaguely British, unmanly men.
The male diplomats, there's a fear that they have that. Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. They do.
You know, they'd be military generals, but they're not, so they become foreign service officers.
Right. Well, and my point is that they're insecure. Sensitive to the charge. And there are all these sort of epithets that are hurled their way, like they're called pink tea types or cookie pushers or striped pants boys. And these are, you know, these are not just insults. They often there's this sort of subtext that these are wimps and that they're sissies.
Yeah.
Or later on, it's going to feed into an accusation that a lot of these men are gay. And there was a lavender scare in the 50s where the government was purged, and a lot of the purge was directed at the State Department and diplomats. And in case I forget to mention it, between I want to say 1947 and 53, I think the stat is 400 men were either fired or forced to resign from the Foreign Service and State Department for the accusation that they were homosexual.
400.
400. Yeah.
Wow.
By the way, and that was just part of a larger purge of the entire federal government, but it was particularly pronounced. So, and my argument is that that makes this particular group of men even less likely to welcome women to their ranks because they're sensitive to the charge that they themselves are not manly.
Oh boy. Yeah. It not only becomes the situation becomes clearer to the reader, but it also becomes more complex because there are, as you say, these different layers of, if you will,
right,
discrimination and attitude,
right,
holding things back. Well, how do things eventually begin to change, if you will?
Well, they begin to change, not coincidentally, in the 1920s, right after the 19th Amendment, which did not give women the right to vote, as I found out from Professor Buzzkill.
That's right. One of our episodes a few weeks ago.
Yeah. Yes. But nevertheless, that was part of a sort of movement to get women in more access to government. There was additional pressure in the 20s to get women into the government. You had some surprisingly receptive people like the Secretary of State, Charles Evans Hughes, in the 20s, who actually basically said, look, we're going to professionalize the Foreign Service. We're going to have a standardized entrance exam. And if women pass it, we have to admit them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, and then that meant that the old hands, the senior diplomats under the secretary, were basically dragged kicking and screaming into admitting the first few women. And there were only a few. Louise sorry, Lucille Atchison was the first. She passed the exam, was admitted to the Foreign Service, and then, as I explained, look, I won't get into it now, but she was basically treated like crap. She was discriminated against.
Yeah.
And she ended up getting married, and there was a de facto marriage ban in place until 1971.
1971.
That's not a typo. Yes, and by the way, and it was just for the record, it was completely sexist. In other words,
yeah.
Men, of course, were allowed to get married. In fact, men could, for a long time, until the late 30s, men could also marry foreign nationals.
Oh.
Which was absolutely no trouble, whereas the minute a woman gets married, she is expected to resign. And if she wouldn't have resigned, she would have been fired. There was no formal rule, but it was a de facto rule in place until 1971.
And by the way, this is not uncommon in other professions or other walks of life. You're expected to sort of resign or give up a career if you got married, if you were a woman.
Well, like teaching, for example, you were supposed you were supposed to be married to the kids, in effect.
Yeah.
And that was true well into the 20th century. So only a relative handful, through 1930 or so, you only have a half dozen Foreign Service officers. Who are women, and they don't last more than a few years typically. Mm-hmm. So we're not even a handful. So I agree that attitudes were very slow to change, and the men really didn't have much to worry about. The pace of change was super super slow, and I in my first chapter by basically saying they had no reason to expect that there would ever be a woman running an embassy or a legation. As an ambassador, as a minister,
I imagine that during the 20s and the 30s, the men might have employed the argument that look, the 30s especially, this is a very tense time, especially in the diplomatic end. You know, we can't have female ambassadors who might have to deal with effectively the ambassador to Ethiopia might be the have to deal
sure.
with the Italian ambassador to Ethiopia during time of the rise of fascism.
Right.
So you need that. That strength thing that they believed in.
Right. And I didn't see any concrete evidence of that, but I have to assume that happened where, you might have someone say, once again, well, maybe someday, but these are turbulent times,
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, well, when are the times not turbulent?
Yes, that's right.
Right. I always love that. In these uncertain times. Yeah, those certain times. What were those?
Yeah. Well, speaking of turbulent times, this is probably a good time for us to take a little break, and we'll do that, and we'll come back in a moment. Hi, Buzzkillers. In this break, I'd like to tell you about how much we've been laughing here at the Buzzkill Institute. That's right, laughing. Recently, we put out a call on Twitter and Facebook asking you to send in recordings that we can use for the intro to the show. You're doing it in great numbers, and they're witty, they're kind, and usually hilarious. We just got one from Buzzkiller in Oregon that made us cry with laughter, and I can't wait to put it in rotation. So please send more. You'll become famous. Here's what to do. Record an intro for Professor Buzzkill on your computer or your phone. Keep it short. One or two sentences, but say what you want. Throw in some Buzzkill catchphrases, crikey and totally stoked. Make fun of me or the show. Mention Professor Nash if you're so moved. Include your name and use Buzzkill as your last name if you want to assure anonymity. Your hometown and a funny local reference or piece of local lingo. And, of course, don't forget to say something like, here's the Professor Buzzkill History Podcast and Busting Myths and Taking Names. Send the audio file to info@professorbuzzkill.com and we'll get it on the show as soon as we can. Thanks a lot. And now back to more serious stuff on the show. All right, we're back with Professor Nash talking about female ambassadors in the American Foreign Service and in American history, particularly 20th century history. And before we left to go to the break, we talked about, or you talked about, I should say, the things slowly starting to change before World War II. So change did come, right?
Yes, it did. And here I should pause to note that one of the weird things about our system, I'm pretty sure we are the only... At least, certainly at the time we were the only sort of advanced industrial Western country that did not have a 100% professional foreign service. I'm sure this is true in the British case, and I think it's true elsewhere. In other words, all ambassadors are career professional diplomats who spend their entire careers working their way up from basically secretary up, you know, it takes decades, and then become an ambassador. The United States, from very early on, always set aside a fluctuating but significant number of its ambassador slots for political appointees.
That's why Joseph Kennedy,
for example, Joseph Kennedy, correct.
Yeah. Under FDR's ambassador to Britain, yeah.
Correct, absolutely. And it's still an issue today. It flares up every so often because it's a lot of slots where, especially in a system like ours, which is lubricated by large amounts of money, that you incur a lot of campaign debts, and one way to pay them off is with ambassadorships to political appointees. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And by the way, just for the record, some of these people have been brilliant. Some of them have been good. Some of them have been so-so. Some of them have been disasters. That is also true of the professionals. So, you know, people roll their eyes when they hear about a particularly disastrous political appointment. That can be a problem. My point here is that in the U.S. context, this political appointment culture means that the breakthrough for women comes much earlier, I would say decades earlier than it would have come otherwise.
It actually turns out to be a good thing.
Absolutely.
In that
way. For example, Great Britain, they do not admit women to their foreign service until 1946, so 24 years after we do.
Yeah, and after the big war, yeah.
Right, and since all of their ambassadors are professionals, that means they don't have one. They could not have had one before 1946, and I don't think they actually do have one mm-hmm. until the early 60s. Uh-huh. The United States is actually relatively advanced compared to other countries in this regard. But what it means is, out of the blue, 1933, Franklin Roosevelt, the new president, he appoints the first female chief of mission, and even though that's an awkward phrase, chief of mission, it's the more accurate one, because to say ambassador, especially in this time, it's about your level of representation in country X. You have a lower level, which would mean you only have a legation, and that is run by a minister. And at the higher mm-hmm. level, you have an embassy, which is run by an ambassador. The ambassador and the minister, those are both chiefs of mission. And that's still the term they use in the State Department. Okay. I mean, so I've often used ambassador or even chief as shorthand. But technically, it's, the first woman is not an ambassador. That's not until 1949. But this is still the key breakthrough. This is someone who's running a legation. They are the highest ranking U.S. diplomat in country X. And so Roosevelt breaks the ice by appointing Ruth Bryan Owen as minister to Denmark in the spring of 1933.
Now, let me just ask here that, you know, I would have expected, or I would have thought before I read the book, that the first female head of mission would have been at some, if you will, I don't know, more out of the way country. This is Denmark in soon to be war torn Europe, and
that's true.
It gets, you know, it becomes eventually one of the battlegrounds for World War II. So this seems to be a pretty big deal. It wasn't Portugal.
Right. No, that's true.
And I don't mean to upset Portuguese buzzkillers, but you know what I mean.
Right. No, although I point out that, remember, Denmark was a traditional neutral.
Country. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And countries like Denmark and Norway and the Netherlands, they had managed to stay out of World War One, and that's one of the reasons why they are generally unprepared for World War Two, is because they were going to try and run the same playbook, and the Nazis had other plans. But
those Nazis.
Also keep in mind that these are also countries like Denmark and Norway. They are, in the world of 1933, gender progressive themselves. In other words, they're places where women already have advanced further than in many other societies. And so the belief is they will take less offense.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So in a way, I would argue, since Denmark, it's not Great Britain, it's not Germany, it's a minor state in Europe, that's not a coincidence. They wouldn't have sent them someplace where it would seem to be riskier. And you're right, Denmark's going to be invaded in 1940. But the idea was, this is a safe, small place for a woman.
Right.
And Ruth Bryan Owen, she, Bryan, that should ring a bell for our American history buffs. She is actually the oldest daughter of William Jennings Bryan.
One of the most famous politicians and political figures in the late 19th, early 20th century.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, three-time candidate for president. He was Secretary of State. Yeah. He took part in the Scopes Monkey Trial. He He's one of the leading populist politicians of the late 19th century. And by the way, if you're wondering why was she picked, there was certainly some evidence that you appoint her in part because there are still a lot of Democrats in 1933 with fond memories of William Jennings Bryan, and so you're certainly going to get some support in that sense. But by the way, she was a fairly accomplished woman. She was a widow, and that's true of the first three women. That's not a coincidence, right? You have to be generally free to do this, right? That's one of those, right? Women back then tended to follow their husbands, and so this freedom of widowhood, if I can call it that. But she was, just before this, she was a two-term congresswoman. In fact, she was the first U.S. congresswoman from the South. She represented Florida's 4th District between 1929 and 1933. And she was primaried and she lost in the spring of 1932 over the issue of prohibition.
Oh boy. Yeah. Domestic politics and foreign affairs linked through prohibition.
She was one of these people who was a dry past the time when it was politically popular. So basically the wet forces, if I can use that term, they primaried her and crushed her in the primary. So she was a lame duck. She very wisely campaigned very hard for Roosevelt in the fall of 1932. And so then her political reward was a position as minister to Denmark. She served credibly by all accounts. She was forced to step down in 1936, partly because she wanted to campaign for Roosevelt, because he was up for re-election. But she also made the mistake of marrying a Dane.
Which is not only getting married, but marrying a foreigner.
A foreigner, but also one of the king of Denmark, one of his lifeguards. Here you see the double standard. Now it is true that under Danish law she would have become a Danish citizen, and so you can imagine that right there is sort of a deal breaker if you're going to be an American diplomat.
Right.
You know, she wanted to keep her job, but there's no way she could have kept her job. And once again, you do see the double standard. Had the genders been reversed, this might have been a very different outcome. So she was the first, and she served well enough for Roosevelt to turn around in the next year, 1937, and appoint another woman. And this is Florence Jaffrey Harriman, known as Daisy Harriman.
Is she any relation to the famous Harrimans, or is she
distant?
Too early for that?
And through marriage, she married, I believe, a cousin of E.H. Harriman, the great railroad magnate. And once again, he was sort of a Wall Street broker who died in 1914 when Harriman was 44. But Harriman had already been making her way in Democratic Party politics. She was one of the most prominent Democratic women in the Wilson era. She helped get Woodrow Wilson elected. She was the first woman to occupy a post on a federal commission under Wilson. And she also, in the 20s and 30s, when the Democrats are out of power, she runs one of the most prominent salons in Washington, D.C., where people like, Winston Churchill come to dinner. She, even though she backed the wrong horse in 1932 and had to wait a little while before she got back in FDR's good graces, she was sent by Roosevelt to Norway in 1937. And I have to point out that he agreed, he had been lobbied to do this by Molly Dewson, who was the highest ranking woman in the Democratic Party at the time, who was pushing for Harriman to get posts. She was pushing for Harriman to get a post, and Roosevelt said, well, I'm only going to send her to a country that's out of harm's way. In other words, a country that's not going to take part in European war, because once again, Norway was neutral in World War One. So fast forward to April 9th, 1940.
I guess it's still technically neutral, but
it is, but not anymore. That's when the Blitzkrieg. that's when the Blitzkrieg comes to town, and people can read about the details. But it's an amazing story where she's basically ordered to keep up with the Norwegian government and Norwegian royal family, who are literally on the lam.
This is a dramatic story.
For days, trying to elude German bombs and German ground forces who are trying to capture them. And basically, she her Ford automobile becomes the U.S. legation, and and in fact, her military attaché during this chase, her military attaché is actually killed by a German bomb splinter, and he was the first U.S. death in World War II. And that easily could have been her. She was only a short distance away. Yeah. So she did a great job there. She won great praise even from FDR. And, it was a fluke. She wasn't supposed to be put in harm's way like that, but she was, and she performed brilliantly. And so it's a great sort of step along the way in this story.
But I just have to, at the risk of too much levity, take you up on your phrase, when the Blitzkrieg comes to town, because that's obviously the title of the worst heavy metal band documentary ever.
I did not know that.
Well, no, I'm just making that up. But,
okay.
And don't, none of you buzz killers out there get any ideas. Don't go name your garage
don't
band.
Don't do a Google search.
Yeah, that's right. But that's in many ways impressive. FDR, within his, correct my chronology if I'm wrong, within the first two terms, already has appointed the first two.
Correct.
With female ambassadors, right? Okay.
Right, and then you have a gap. Roosevelt does not appoint another woman during World War II. Perhaps not a coincidence, and it's not until 1949, under his successor Harry S. Truman, when we reach number three, and that is the famous Pearl Mesta, the hostess with the mostess. the same Pearl Mesta, who also, I argue, was a far more impressive figure than she normally gets credit for. She is obviously renowned as Washington, D.C.'s famous society hostess.
Right.
She inspired the very successful musical Call Me Madam in the early 50s. Yeah. Right. In fact, they were actually going to use the country's name Luxembourg. But Luxembourg authorities complained, and so in the musical and the movie, it's Lichtenberg.
The Marx Brothers having Fredonia as one of their...
Pretty much. Yeah. They only slightly fictionalize it. But because a lot of people at the time thought it was hilarious that this woman who has no experience is sent to represent, you know, and she was sort of nouveau riche, right? She was considered sort of not very high class by a lot of people. And so the idea that she was sent to this sort of old European monarchy, it was a Grand Duchy, Luxembourg.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Mesta actually, she married a Pittsburgh steel magnate by the name of George Mesta. And he died in 1925. And so she was a very wealthy widow, but she was still active in the Mesta Machine Corporation for many years. She was involved in the National Women's Party, one of the leading feminist parties in the 30s.
Ah.
She successfully ran a very large cattle ranch during World War II.
Wow.
And after World War II, during and after World War II, she was shrewd enough to befriend Harry Truman before he was really, really important. And so then after World War II, and especially considering the fact that Bess Truman was not interested in becoming a very prominent hostess, the way was clear for someone like Pearl Mesta, heavily tied to the Democrats, to become sort of the reigning hostess of Washington, D.C., and by the way, a brilliant fundraiser for the Democratic Party. There was one point in the famous Give 'em Hell Harry campaign of 1948, there was one point where basically the campaign was completely strapped, had no cash, and so she basically shook down all her friends to pile the coffers back up.
Wow. This is one of these sort of partly political, partly campaign-based appointments, maybe.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, this was the political gift. And I would argue she had the greatest obstacles to overcome. She faced the most severe hostility from the Career Foreign Service and the people in the State Department, which I talk about at great length in the book. But, she did a lot of party giving. She was not the most impressive figure, but I argue that she did surprisingly well considering all the baggage she brought to the job. Far more impressive is Truman's other female appointment, and that is Eugenie Anderson from Minnesota, who was a Hubert H. Humphrey protege, very, very active and very successful in Minnesota party politics leading up to 1949 when she was sent as ambassador to Denmark. So she's the first one to get the rank ambassador.
And, oh, okay. Yeah.
And her granddaughter actually just wrote a very good book just about her, whereas in my book, where she just gets a chapter. Her papers are at the Minnesota Historical Society, and they are an amazing resource.
Mm-hmm.
But so she also came from politics. You could easily make the case that she's the best of the half dozen women I study. She was super, super sharp, very, very hands-on, sort of a prodigy, I would say. When she was appointed, she was 40 years old, and she was the youngest ambassador in the United States, Diplomatic Corps. But she did an amazing job.
Especially a profession where seniority seemed to matter a lot.
Absolutely. She's the first woman to negotiate a treaty, which she negotiates with the Danes. She's out of politics, sort of out of diplomacy in the 50s because it's the Eisenhower period. But when JFK comes in, he names her minister to Bulgaria.
Okay, now that would seem to me to be one of these marginal, I mean, off to the side countries. But in your book, you show it's not.
Absolutely. The thing is, up until this point, people like John Foster Dulles, who was Eisenhower's Secretary of State, he never wanted to send a woman to Eastern Europe. And obviously, there's no memo where he explains why, but it's pretty clear it's because, you know, there's a rough and tumble aspect.
Yeah.
It's a bigger challenge. There are greater risks. The sort of Soviet bloc intelligence agencies are hard at work, as they were in Bulgaria, you know, looking to exploit people and take advantage of them or compromise them. They had all these operations in place. Anyway, so it's a really, really tough job and a really, really grim place, but she does an amazing job. Even people like George Kennan, who by this point, you know, he's the career diplomat, one of our most famous diplomats, architect of the containment policy, very famous guy, and by the way, quite a misogynist. He went out of his way to send sort of an improper memo to the Secretary of State just saying what an amazing job Eugene Anderson was doing next door in Bulgaria. This is when Kennan was stepping down as ambassador to Yugoslavia. But, and just to give you one little taste, the Bulgarian authorities, she asked, can I address the Bulgarian people on Bulgarian state television?
Yeah.
And the Bulgarian government said, sure, if you do it in Bulgarian.
Oh,
and of course,
gee, thanks.
Yeah, right. And of course, their assumption is, well, she would never do that. Well, this being Eugenie Anderson, she had done the same thing in Denmark. She learned a lot of Danish. She learned enough Bulgarian to give her speech in Bulgarian. So she was the first Western diplomat to address the Bulgarian people on Bulgarian state TV.
Well, that's amazing. And Bulgarian is like Hungarian. It's not something you just pick up.
No, I don't know what, the State Department ranks languages, you know, like Arabic's the toughest and Spanish is the easiest. Bulgarian has got to be toward the top, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They got the Cyrillic
alphabet
and, yeah. Anyway, she learned enough to give a short speech on TV in Bulgarian. So she retired from that position in 1964.
Okay, so we have two female ambassadors under Roosevelt. And then Truman is two, or are there more?
Correct. No, that's two. That's correct. Two under Truman. And then you basically have two under Eisenhower, although technically, in terms of appointments, because one of the women gets three, and Claire Booth Lewis is actually appointed to two, although she only takes one. So technically, Eisenhower makes five female appointments, but once again, like with his predecessors, you never have more than two women occupying these posts at the same time. So
is there an indication that the State Department or the old hands in Washington are saying, okay, we can have two token ones, but that's enough?
I have no evidence to that effect. I'm sure there would have been no difference whether it was one or two or five. I think anything north of that probably would have worried them. But the point is, yes, they are tokens, and because they were tokens, the men were sort of okay with it. You know, they were willing to put up with it because it was nothing you hadn't seen since the mid-1930s. So you have a couple. What they probably weren't so happy with is the fact that Eisenhower named Claire Booth Luce ambassador to Italy.
Yes, now a lot of buzzkillers would have heard of her.
Sure, she is. You can argue. I would argue that apart from maybe Eleanor Roosevelt, she's the most accomplished American woman of the entire 20th century. If you look at her entire career, this is a woman who was a magazine editor, very successful playwright on Broadway. She was a war correspondent. She was a two-term congresswoman from Connecticut. She was a powerful force in the Republican Party. She was also married to Henry Luce, who of course was the probably the leading media mogul of the mid-20th century, right? He's the
one who
ran Time, Life, Fortune, Sports Illustrated. I mean, it was media empires were different back then, but he was very, very powerful. And of course, one of the reasons they appoint her is because she is married to him.
Yeah.
Let's be honest. But she is sent to Italy, which makes her the first woman sent to a major ally.
Right.
Because, you know, it's not France or Britain or Germany, but it's Italy, major player, sort of on the front line of the Cold War. This is 1953. It was an extremely controversial appointment, not only in Italy, but also in the United States. She had converted to Catholicism in 1946.
And that might have been a problem.
Oh, absolutely. Well, remember, there's still a lot of anti-Catholic bigotry in the United States, and people worry that, you know, she's going to be in Rome, right? She's going to go take orders from the Vatican,
which, of
course, is a horrible slur. But there were people, and you know, in the Eisenhower Library, they have some of the letters where people object to her appointment. The fact that she was a woman was a big issue, especially in Italy. I quote in the book an Italian foreign office official who said, and when he found out about it, and I'm quoting, "What do you think we are, Luxembourg?"
Oh, my God.
End quote. In other words, this is about prestige, and especially in a very sort of patriarchal, sort of macho culture like in Italy in the 1950s, this was considered in many circles an insult. Not in all circles. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they went ahead and accepted the appointment. And they were glad they did, because, and this is another way where these political appointments actually help sort of work out via the back door, if I can say that. By that I mean someone like Clare Booth Luce has access to the White House that most career diplomats could only dream of, right?
Yeah,
She can literally call up Eisenhower on the phone, and the Italians very quickly come to appreciate that. For example, she plays a very key role in settling the dispute over Trieste, which was a city at the top of the Adriatic, which was disputed between Italy and Yugoslavia. This was a dispute that easily could have led to war in 1953 or 1954 between those two countries. And she apparently actually went to the White House and banged on Eisenhower's desk to get him to launch a major diplomatic effort to get this thing solved. And it was solved, and that's a huge feather in her cap, and the Italians were absolutely delighted. And one of the reasons why they had a bunch of beefs with her, for example, her very staunch anti-communism and her meddling in Italian politics, but they really came to appreciate her, and it's because of her access. She was very popular when she stepped down in 1956. She was by a couple of days, she was technically ambassador to Brazil in 1959. She was appointed, but she very quickly resigned because it turns out she didn't want the job. There's actually much more to the story than that, but I will leave that to readers. And then finally we have Frances Willis, who I mentioned at the outset. She was the first woman to work her way up through the career Foreign Service. It took her essentially a quarter of a century, which is a little bit longer. I mean, there are a lot of men who never become ambassador. There were also a bunch of men who became ambassador who entered the Foreign Service the same year she did, but became ambassador much more quickly than she did.
Let's
keep that in mind. But she is appointed ambassador to Switzerland by Ike in 1953. Interesting choice, because at that time, Swiss women did not yet have the right to vote.
Yes, that could be a little galling to an ambassador.
And if you're looking to avoid controversy, right? I mean, like, how is the Swiss government going to react? And by the way, just for the record, Swiss women don't get the right to vote until 1971.
Yeah. Do we know how they reacted? Do we know that the Swiss government?
We have some idea. They actually were pretty okay with it, partly because, here's the flip side, partly because she was a professional.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
And in other words, this is the flip side. Countries like Switzerland, they often get political appointees. And sometimes, as I said, sometimes these people are hacks. Sometimes these people are basically looking for a paid vacation, or they're not very bright, or they have no relevant experience. Where someone like this, who is, you know, a diplomat to her core, and obviously very competent. For example, she was a first secretary, which is a very high rank, in the London embassy in the early years of the Cold War. So, you know, she had the chops. And so
Very important spot.
Well, also they knew that I'm sure if they thought about it for 5 minutes, they knew that Eisenhower and John Foster Dulles were not feminists. They were not sending any message with this. So they generally were okay with it, and she was very, very discreet and very diplomatic and handled it very well and did an amazing job. And she did well enough that she was sent in 1957 to Norway.
Right.
So you see the pattern here? Women tending to be sent. In case I forget to mention it, up through today, the country that has gotten the most American women sent as ambassador is Luxembourg. We have sent 7 women to Luxembourg. And then there's some countries like Russia and Spain where we have sent something like 70 some ambassadors and not a single woman. You see the pattern. Anyway, so in other words, even though you're only talking about a token number, you're already seeing this pattern, right? Where the women tend to be sent to either neutral or less important allied countries in Northern Europe that aren't, you know, basically aren't that important as France or Britain or Germany. Anyway, so she's sent to Norway. Then 1961, her last post, Kennedy sends her to Ceylon, today Sri Lanka. And once again, just like sending Mesta to Luxembourg, part of the reason is Ceylon at the time was run by a female prime minister. And it's a little patronizing, right? It's like, oh, they'll get along great. They're both women. I mean, it's pretty silly. I'll be diplomatic and call it silly. I would also, the last thing I'll say about Willis, she did a very good job. There's no question about it. She was much admired. Lots of men who worked for her thought she was sort of the best person they ever worked for. She made her way up to the top ranks, which once again was not, like, you know, it's not a foregone conclusion. You can spend your entire career at a much lower level when you you're at a much lower level when you retire. She made it to the top partly because some of the original old hands, some of the original founders of the modern Foreign Service, men who typically were opposed to having women in the Foreign Service at any rank, people like Hugh Gibson and Joseph Grew, these are people who found out firsthand how good she was, and they boosted her career. So in other words, one of the questions... to me, one of the obvious questions here is, did these women, even though they were small in number, did they change any minds? And I think the answer is yes. And even though sometimes the evidence is hard to find, in this case, the evidence is crystal clear. These are men who, we have them in letters opposing the admission of women in the 1920s. And then by the 1940s, they're saying to themselves, why isn't this woman Willis have an ambassadorship yet?
So
to me, I mean, you know, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. Yeah. These are men who have, at least in this case, have had their minds changed.
That's an extremely significant factor.
That's what I argue.
So these are the 6 women that you chose to write about. So are there sort of overarching things we can say about them, or more importantly, you can say about them as a group?
Yes, there are, but I think looking at the clock, maybe we should talk about that in the next episode.
Oh, that's right. Yes, we are pushing up against time. But one thing we should say to Buzzkillers, and I deliberately left this till the end, is that Professor Nash has very, very kindly donated a book to the Buzzkill Institute for us to give out to one of our Patreon subscribers. And if I have our phone messaging correct, he's going to inscribe it to you. If you're the first Patreon subscriber to email me and say you'd like to have a copy of Breaking Protocol, personalized by Professor Nash, you will get it. So this is the first time we've ever done this, and because, of course, Professor Nash is so important and the book is so important.
Thank you for that, and I will be happy to sign that copy.
Okay, but for now, for this episode anyway, it just remains for me to thank Professor Nash for coming on.
My pleasure.
And Buzzkillers, we will talk to you next week.